Hello, everyone. I know a man. He was born in an obscure village, the child of a poor peasant woman. And then he grew up in still another obscure village where he worked as a carpenter until he was 30 years old. He didn't have much. He never wrote a book. He never held an office. He never had a family. He never owned a house. He never went to college. He never visited a big city. He never went 200 miles from where he was born. He did none of the usual things that the world would associate with greatness. He had no credentials but himself. He was only 33 when the tide of public opinion turned against him. He said, they called him a rabble-rouser. They called him a troublemaker. They said he was an agitator. He practiced civil disobedience. He broke injunctions. And so he was turned over to his enemies and went through a mockery of a trial. As you all might know, these are the words of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. from his Drum Major Instinct speech, given just a few months before his assassination. We all know the civil rights leader, Martin Luther King, who led the March on Washington and helped get the Civil Rights Act and Voting Rights Act passed. But fewer of us are familiar with the King who committed his last years to the eradication of poverty. Martin Luther King spent the last year of his life making connections between racism, militarism, and poverty. His last crusade was the Poor People's Campaign. He insisted, what good is it to be able to sit at a lunch counter if you can't afford to buy a hamburger? He took note of the poverty in the northern cities brought to light, particularly in the 1965 Watts Rebellion, and the poverty in Appalachia portrayed through images in Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty in 1964 and 66. He wanted the nation to do something about this widespread poverty and called for a revolution of values. The Poor People's Campaign aimed to save the soul of America. It was an effort to unite poor people across racial and geographic lines to make a real war on poverty, with poor people at the lead, so that things like the Vietnam War could not turn the war on poverty into a skirmish, and resources could not be diverted away from those who really needed them. Central to King's vision of a Poor People's Campaign was massive civil disobedience in hospitals, welfare centers, and government and corporate buildings until the needs of the poor were met. Reverend Dr. King challenged, America must be born again, saying, we must see now that the evils of racism, economic exploitation, and militarism are all tied together, and you can't get rid of one of them without getting rid of the other. Jesus confronted this problem of the interrelatedness of evil one day, or rather, it was one night. A big shot came to him and asked Jesus a question. What shall I do to be saved? Jesus didn't get bogged down in a specific evil. He looked at Nicodemus, and he didn't say, now, Nicodemus, you must not drink liquor. He didn't say, Nicodemus, you must not commit adultery. He didn't say, Nicodemus, you must not lie. He didn't say, Nicodemus, you must not steal. He said, Nicodemus, you must be born again. In other words, Nicodemus, the whole structure of your life must be changed. Now that is what we are dealing with in America. Somebody must say to America, America, if you have contempt for life, if you exploit human beings by seeing them as less than human, if you will not treat human beings as a means to an end, you thingify those human beings. And if you thingify a person, you will exploit them economically. And if you will exploit persons economically, you will abuse your military power to protect your economic investments and your economic exploitations. So what America must be told today is that she must be born again. The whole structure of American life must be changed. So when brought to Marks, Mississippi in the Mississippi Delta, in the poorest county of the United States in 1968 for a colleague's funeral and toured around the town, King dropped to his knees and cried because of the deep-seated poverty he witnessed. He called a town meeting at Eudora AME Zion Church. From there, he determined to start the mule train to Washington, the central caravan of poor people that met up with caravans of poor people from all over the country at Resurrection City, a major tent city on the Mall in Washington, D.C., in the summer of 68. This last year of King's life, particularly his focus on building the Poor People's Campaign and his call to lift the load of poverty, actually parallels the last week and the greater mission of Jesus Christ's life, death, and resurrection. In an effort to honor Reverend Dr. King, in this online seminar, I will explore the connection of the last year of King and the last week of Jesus. I believe we will perhaps find implications for our anti-poverty ministries today from the radical lives and legacies of King and Christ. The larger purpose of this seminar in honor of MLK Day is to invite you all to join us in reigniting the Poor People's Campaign and finishing the unfinished business of Martin Luther King Jr. We believe King's business is the business of Jesus Christ and that we are all called to take up this work. Let us therefore take seriously the theories and the theologies of Jesus Christ and Martin Luther King Jr. in an effort to live up to what they demand from their followers. So what's the connection between Martin Luther King Jr., the Poor People's Campaign of 1968, Jesus Christ, and poor people organizing today? Let's begin with looking at Jesus, particularly the last week of his activities that led to his crucifixion as a rebel of the empire. Perhaps a starting point is the ways that Jesus was contrasted with and opposed to Caesar, the emperor of Rome during Jesus' lifetime. Jesus was called the same titles as the emperor, things like Lord, Son of God, Bearer of Peace, King of Kings, etc. Even though Jesus was a poor peasant from Galilee who spent his time healing, teaching, and organizing other poor peasants. Jesus was doing many of the same activities as the emperor and other political leaders of his days were supposed to, feeding people, healing, exercises, diseases, and demons, looking after the people. But Jesus' meals were things like the feeding of the 5,000, where lots of poor people share a meal, and they share a small amount of food, but it becomes enough. And Jesus' healthcare plan didn't cost a thing. We could go on about these contrasts between Jesus and the rulers of his day, but let's look at a specific example, the entry into Jerusalem. John Dominic Crossan and Marcus Ford, leading historical Jesus scholars, talk about the last week of Jesus and the entry into Jerusalem in their book, The Last Week, what the gospel really teaches about Jesus' final days in Jerusalem. Jesus enters Jerusalem on a borrowed donkey, not a chariot, not even a horse. And this could be viewed as a parallel procession of Caesar's imperial guard. There are two processions going on Palm Sunday. Jesus riding in on a mule, a lowly animal mocking the procession of the Roman governor Pontius Pilate, King Herod's military forces entering Jerusalem to do crowd control and protest disciplining of the rowdy fisher people and farmers gathered in Jerusalem for Passover. Once Jesus enters Jerusalem, he goes to the temple to check things out. And then he returns to the temple on Monday and causes a scene there. Reverend Barber of the Forward Together Moral Mondays movement in North Carolina calls this scene in the temple on the Monday after Palm Sunday the original Moral Monday. I want to suggest that when Jesus stops the buying and selling going on in the temple, pronounces it as a den of robbers, a safe house for people who are stealing and cheating the poor, he is actually doing civil disobedience. Let's try to imagine the scene. The Jerusalem temple is not just the religious center of Jerusalem, but the economic and political center as well. The temple is the central bank. It's the place where the log of all the debts of the poor are kept. And it's structured and controlled to fit into the hierarchical order of Roman society. In fact, there's a Roman security post at the top of the temple and a guard on duty to watch and police who's entering and exiting. who's doing what. There's a place for everyone. Everyone has their place in this temple. Indeed, a sign was posted in the temple that said that if a Gentile crossed into the section reserved for Jews, that this was punishable by death by the Roman police force. So when Jesus enters the temple, turns over the table of everyone who is buying and selling, this is quite a demonstration, right? To shut it down, thousands of people would have had to join Jesus' public protest and action. That's how big and busy the temple is. And it is both after this teaching and healings earlier in Mark or earlier in the Gospel of Matthew, but especially these acts of civil disobedience here in this scene, where it is determined that Jesus must be crucified by the elites. And I want to say a word about crucifixion here as well. Crucifixion was the punishment reserved for revolutionaries, for insurrectionists against Rome. Common robbers and tax evaders were not crucified. Even murderers were not crucified. Political prisoners, social movement organizers, alternative authorities were. So even if all we know about Jesus Christ is that he's crucified by Rome, and all of us know a whole lot more from our Bible, then we know who Jesus is. He's a revolutionary leader who is deemed a threat to Rome's status quo. And this perhaps is where a parallel with King and the Poor People's Campaign comes in. The last campaign in March that King participated in was the Memphis sanitation workers' strike. King was invited to and resolved to help lead this march. There weren't two parallel marches in Memphis. Instead, the Imperial Guard, in this case, the Memphis Police and the National Guard, monitored the march and managed the crowd at this procession. But after the first sanitation workers' strike march makes a disruption to those in power, the surveillance of Martin Luther King and his assassination is further plotted as well. And also what we know about King and the Poor People's Campaign is that it starts in Marks, Mississippi with a mule train. Marks is in the poorest county in the United States. Marks is the poorest county in the United States in 1968, just like Galilee was one of the poorest places in the Roman Empire 2,000 years ago. Poor folks from Marks set off on mules, on donkeys, to enter Washington, D.C., the political and economic, and we could even say religious center of the United States, just like Jerusalem was the center of Judea within Rome. Folks might know that the Jerusalem Temple was one of the wonders of the world at this time. And when I bring my young kids to Washington, D.C., the mall and all of those imperial buildings, it inspires awe and wonder from them as well. So imagine poor families coming into Washington, D.C. on mules, on donkeys, burdened down with their poor kids, entering the nation's capital to demand that they need food and health care and jobs that pay a decent wage. This scene of the mule train of the Poor People's Campaign, in fact, should change the image all of us have in our minds of the triumphal entry into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday. This Easter season, instead of thinking of Jesus riding in on some chariot with a donkey pulling it this time, where even though we know it's a donkey and not a horse, we still impose a grand and beautiful entrance. Imagine poor families from the poorest part of our country clamoring in on mule, carrying what little they have, desperate for a radical change in our nation's priorities. If you think of the mule train and all those poor families from Marks joining poor families from other parts of the country in a raggedy protest in the nation's capital, it will be a lot closer to what Jesus was doing on Palm Sunday than what we normally think of. And what the people did when they got to DC was to set up a resurrection city. Let's notice the religious language. From this tent city, poor people of all races left every day to go to protest and do civil disobedience in hospitals and Department of Agricultural buildings and other temples of our day. Despite King being killed before the mule train in Resurrection City, all of these that follow from his proposal of a Poor People's Campaign and were disruptive as well. So in order to draw the connection between Jesus and the Jesus movement and King and the Poor People's Campaign even more, we should talk about King's assassination, the abandonment of lots of King's friends who were not really able to carry the Poor People's Campaign to a successful conclusion, and the rebirth of a campaign by poor people nearly 50 years later, both by people who have been fighting to end poverty from Marx and all over the country for the past 50 years, and poor people who are joining together to reignite that Poor People's Campaign today. Indeed, although not enough people discussed the unpopularity of Martin Luther King at his death, this past week as we celebrated MLK Day, exactly 1 year before his assassination, the day after he preached his Time to Break the Silence sermon, taking a public stance for the first time against the Vietnam War at the Riverside Church on April 4th, 1967, 168 newspapers and organizations came out against him, saying things like civil rights and peace don't mix, that he was hurting the cause of Black people, that he had lost his power and spirit. To me, this sounds a little bit about the Garden of Eden, the Garden of Gethsemane, and Jesus and his followers to me. Not known to enough people, in 1999, the District Court of Tennessee actually found that all levels of the U.S. government were complicit in the assassination of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Indeed, King was not killed just by a lone racist, but he was followed by military intelligence with the FBI, threatening and harassing him. Indeed, there was a plot, like I allude to above, in the midst of the sanitation workers' strike and before, to discredit and isolate King. It seems from all of this that such a great religious and political leader was killed because he was a threat to the status quo. And it sounds pretty similar to the situation of Jesus as well. So the entry into Jerusalem or in Memphis or Washington, D.C., and the execution as a radical by the state are the beginning and the end of the last week of Jesus Christ and the last year of MLK. But what Jesus does in the middle there and the parallels to Martin Luther King are perhaps what is most important for their followers to learn from today. There's a particularly important biblical story for me that takes place in the last week, in this last week of Jesus's life, is the story of the unnamed woman anointing Jesus. In Matthew 26, this unnamed woman appears at Simon the leper's house with a jar of very expensive ointment as Jesus and his disciples are gathered together. This scene takes place in Bethany, meaning house of the poor in Hebrew, only a few miles from Jerusalem. And while Jerusalem and the temple in particular may represent a place of wealth and power, Jesus and his followers are staying in a place of poverty and marginalization. Another scene similar to the procession with the donkey on Palm Sunday. This could be out of convenience and the fact that they don't have the resources to stay somewhere else. It is also an indication of who Jesus is and with whom he associates. Jesus is staying with Simon the leper in the house of the poor because Jesus himself is concerned with the problems of the poor. The fact that Simon has leprosy may mean that he's poor. It would surely mean that he's ritually unclean and certainly not the type of person hosting and holding dinners for the high priests and Roman authorities in Jerusalem. And in this scene, Jesus is reclining over a meal with his disciples. Jesus shares this kind of what scholars call an open commensality. He socialized and ate with all kinds of people, including lepers and women of unknown backgrounds. Jesus stood for a kingdom, for an empire, for a realm of God that was challenging to the very foundations of the Roman Empire. He practiced a radical egalitarianism that included people of all classes, statuses, abilities, and so on. He asserted that God's kingdom is made up of those completely expendable and excluded from society. A quote from John Dominic Crossan really reminds me of this. In any situation of oppression, especially in those oblique, indirect, and systemic ones where injustice wears a mask of normalcy or even out of necessity, the only ones who are innocent or blessed are those squeezed out deliberately as human junk from the system's own evil operations. A contemporary equivalent, only the homeless are innocent. So the scene in Bethany, as we talked about, follows the entrance into Jerusalem and his visit to the temple. It's actually a continuation, of course, of those teachings and actions. And so he's made a stir in the sanctuary, and he's fled to Bethany for protection and cover amongst the poor and marginalized. He could be staying in Bethany because poor peasants of the town support him and his followers and desire to welcome and protect Jesus, who is coming up against the temple elite and Roman authorities. And so then this woman, after she anoints Jesus in this marginalized place, instead of acknowledging his imminent death or recognizing and celebrating the social critique implicit of anointing a poor person with a luxury item like this happens, the disciples chide the unnamed woman. They critique her for wasting the ointment. They suggest that instead of breaking this alabaster jar and pouring out that ointment on his head to anoint him as Christ, she should have kept it intact and sold the item. Jesus responds to the critique of the woman by his disciples with the phrase, "The poor will be with you always." This line has been interpreted either to establish that God condones poverty, or that although God condemns poverty, it is an unfortunate and unalterable reality of the human condition. For many people, the fact that Jesus is the one that makes this statement about the poor and that he uses the word always makes the meaning clear and unequivocal. Most people don't know where this line actually falls in the biblical story as we're discussing today, nor the context of the Gospel of Matthew or the Gospel of Mark, but say that this biblical statement establishes poverty as perpetual and inevitable. But when Jesus says, "The poor are with you always, but you will not always have me," he's reminding his followers of the Deuteronomic code and God's admonition to forgive debts, to release slaves, and to be generous with one's possessions. He's reminding his followers that he is soon to be executed for his vision of God's vision, God's kingdom on earth, and his practices of these very commandments, as demonstrated through his feedings, his teachings about what to do with wealth and taxes, his disruption of the temple as it happens earlier, and even his audacity to do all of this while being poor himself. So this part of Matthew, this part of Mark, portrays Jesus as passing many of the responsibilities of building a popular movement, a social movement, onto his disciples, these other movement leaders, right before he is killed. In this reading of the Passion narrative, Jesus is a threat to Rome because of what he stands for and also his role in developing leaders committed to his same vision. Jesus himself is poor. His disciples are poor. His statement is not about pitting the poor against Jesus or even pitting the poor Jesus against other poor people. Instead, Jesus is trying to suggest his role, the role of the disciples, the role of a movement in ending everyone's poverty. He is reminding his disciples that with his impending death, they are charged with carrying on his legacy. This argument is backed up through the grammatical structure, actually, of his critique. There's no future prediction in his statement. The verbs are not in the future tense. The disciples have, you have, the poor around them. This is among who the Jesus movement is based. But time is running out for Jesus. You do not always have me. His disciples should understand what needs to be done to end poverty and follow Jesus' vision for the realization of the Deuteronomic Code, the release of slaves, the forgiveness of debts, the generosity in the face of economic hardship. They too must become popular movement leaders, despite their own poverty, despite their own seemingly powerlessness. So Willie Baptist, Poverty Initiative Scholar in Residence, coordinator of poverty scholarship and leadership development for the Kairos Center, and a mentor of mine for more than 20 years, asserts in another interpretation, an additional one, to Matthew 26. He suggests that, in fact, Reverend King was thinking about the passage, "The poor with you always," when he makes his statement about true compassion. King says, "A true revolution of values will soon cause us to question the fairness and justice of many of our past and present policies. On the one hand, we are called to play the Good Samaritan on life's roadside, but that will only be an initial act. One day we must come to see that the whole Jericho Road, must be transformed so that men and women will not constantly be beaten and robbed as they make their journey on life's highway. True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. It is not haphazard or superficial. It comes to see that an edifice that produces beggars needs restructuring. A true revolution of values will soon look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth and say, this is not just. So Willie Baptist says that Jesus critiques the disciples' concern over selling the ointment and argues that giving the money to the poor is like flinging a coin to a beggar. He continues that this woman's act of anointing, recognizing, and honoring Jesus is a celebration of someone whose words and actions stand for the restructuring of an edifice that produces beggars. He connects flinging a coin to a beggar with the establishment of potter's fields for the poor, with the money discarded by the temple elites when Judas returns Jesus' blood money. Indeed, actually juxtaposing this story of the poor will be with you always in Matthew and Martin Luther King text, connecting MLK and Jesus themselves, helps us to bring forth a new liberationist reading, understanding of this passage and of the whole last week of Jesus, or the last year of King. Rather than simply accepting the only response to poverty are band-aid solutions with no critique of economic systems and structures that hurt communities and destroy lives, Dr. King's quote reminds us, especially those of us who consider ourselves Christian, that God requires justice and love for all and judges that which impoverishes and tramples on God's children. Dr. King's quote suggests that while helping individuals is necessary, the only true help for individuals is bettering all of society. This quote and others from King insist that poverty should and could be ended with the organized poor leading the way, a new poor people's campaign. Such a harsh critique of charity in this quote and others I've read above may come as a surprise from Dr. King. Dr. King's quotes are regularly used to justify charity. The call of what people should do in honor of MLK Day, in fact, is to do community service, oftentimes backed up with the quote from Dr. King, everyone can be great because everyone can serve. And when thinking about the experts on poverty alleviation and eradication, our society turns to advocates and service providers for the poor because they seem to be the ones thinking about the needs of the poor. For anyone who is poor ourselves or spends time with people that are poor, meeting the immediate needs of the poor is a very needed and important act. And meeting these needs requires donations of time and money from those more fortunate. Indeed, the follow-up to painting schools and planting community gardens in honor of MLK Day is to make money in order to be able to donate generously to programs that help the poor, all inspired by Reverend Dr. King. But Dr. King's quote on true compassion about an edifice, about a structure that produces beggars, much like the revolution of values that he suggests in his sermon about Nicodemus and America being born again, is one where he calls out against people being constantly beaten and robbed on life's highways. He uses a biblical story that is familiar to many, the story of the Good Samaritan, to say that charity and community service are not sufficient. The story of the Good Samaritan is a Christian favorite. In this story, regular people from the helping professions leave a dying man on the road, but the unlikely, maybe even ungodly Samaritan, a religious outsider, comes to the man's rescue. The Samaritan cares for him, pays for his recovery costs, makes sure that someone continues to look after him. But Dr. King uses this biblical story to actually critique charity and service and say that although helping beggars on life's roadside is important, a more systemic response is necessary. His critique of this structure that includes people earning money in order to be able to donate to the poor or pay others to care for those in need raises questions about a system where people have to buy their very necessities or where people's care is not a right for all. Indeed, a great quote from Dr. King on this is, one day we must ask the question, why are there 40 million poor people in America? And when you begin to ask that question, you are raising questions about the economic system, about a broader distribution of wealth. When you ask that question, you begin to question the capitalistic economy. And I'm simply saying that more and more, we've got to begin to ask questions about the whole society. We are called upon to help the discouraged beggars in life's marketplace. But one day, we must come to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. It means that questions must be raised. And you see, my friends, when you deal with this, you begin to ask the question, who owns the oil? You begin to ask the question, who owns the iron ore? You begin to ask the question, why is it that people have to pay water bills in a world that's two-thirds water? These are the questions that must be asked. So the act of buying and selling and adhering to dominant economic systems, to Dr. King, or for Jesus in the story of Matthew 26, when the disciples suggest that the unnamed woman should have sold the ointment used to anoint Jesus and given the proceeds to the poor, may actually be a small building block in maintaining the very structure that excludes and exploits the poor from the economy. These structures, the whole Jericho Road of our day, confines the vast majority of inhabitants of this earth to dispossession and misery. Jesus speaks out against the buying and selling of commodities and bodies and souls of human beings. Dr. King suggests that structural transformation is the true solution to poverty and oppression. Band-aids, charity, buying into a system that produces poverty is ineffective and insufficient. In fact, they might even be part of the problem. And King's critique of charity is in line with a longer and broader religious critique of impoverishment and charity. Jesus, Muhammad, the Hebrew prophets critique the people, saying that they are too narrowly focused on just poor people in their midst, or on ameliorating poverty rather than ending it. Jesus and King show that people fall back on their kind of regular status quo stances of the empire of their days, and propose solutions that will just make poverty worse. They critique their followers, who suggest selling and participating in dominant oppressive economic systems and assisting the poor through charity and patronage. And they basically make a prophetic critique that if we do not stand up and commit ourselves to ending poverty in the way that King has and calls other people to do, we are walking down a road to a spiritual death. We cannot afford to ignore Reverend Dr. King's call to be compassionate, to call for God's people, to restructure the edifice that produces beggars and billionaires in our society and world. This is King's charge. This is why he called for a Poor People's Campaign. This is what Jesus was crucified for. And this is where we need to heed this call, where we need to take up this mantle, where we need to carry on the legacy. Thank you, and I look forward to our continued discussion on all of this. I'm going to say a quick thing while we're waiting for people to send in comments and questions, which is that a bunch of what I was talking about today is based on a Bible study that a number of us put together quite a few years ago, actually, at this point, but it's still relevant today. It's in a book that the Poverty Initiative and Cairo Center published called A New and Unsettling Force, and there's a chapter that actually is a series of Bible studies that talks about some of the text I was discussing. But we've used it in the past to be a Lenten series. So as we're approaching Lent, as we're moving from King Day past Valentine's Day into Lent, folks can get a hold of that, and we've posted it on our website.
So I'm going to read the first response from Nancy. Thank you, Liz. There's a lot to unpack in this presentation. Can you review again the explanation of Jesus' statement that the poor will be with you always as a call to his followers to fight poverty?
So this is where we're getting into a little bit of trouble, because as people might have heard in the introduction that Colleen made to me, I actually wrote my dissertation on this text, and so I have a lot to say on I have 300-400 pages to say on the topic of that very question. But to say a couple of things, perhaps in addition to what I was saying in this presentation. I mean, I think there's a number of levels of where actually the poor with you always has been interpreted exactly opposite of, I think, how it was originally intended by Jesus. And that is to say that how it's used now to justify poverty, when I think actually it was a very clear critique on Jesus's part of the existence of poverty in his day, and that could still hold. So I think the first level of this is that it's actually a quote of Deuteronomy 15. And Deuteronomy 15, 4 through 11, I think is where the quote is most directed at. And Deuteronomy 15, 4 says that you won't have poor people among you. There will be no needy poor person among you as long as you follow the commandments that I'm giving to you today. And what's given then is three very radical calls. One is the forgiveness of debts. The second is the release of slaves. And third is lending of money, giving of money, even when you know you are not going to get paid back. And then Deuteronomy 11 gets us to basically this point where it said that, but I'm not sure you're going to follow these commandments, and so the poor will never cease to be on earth, which is, so the poor will be with us always. So in quoting that, Jesus is referring to a tradition that his disciples would have been well versed in, which actually reminds people that the existence of poverty, the proliferation of poverty, is not because it's God's will, is not because it's God's plan, it's not because it's inevitable, but actually because of the disobedience of people to follow the very things that could get us out of poverty, which are things like, you know, not letting people get indebted, not buying and selling human beings, and still having systems and policies and structures that provide for the necessities for all. So I think that on the first level is that it's kind of a misquote, or it's a misunderstood quote, when Jesus is actually saying that the reason that poverty exists is because we're not following what we already know needs to happen. It's not that there isn't enough, it's that we're not following the way that society should be organized, which would mean that there would be no needy poor people among us. So I think on some level that's a very strong, you know, stance on this. I think the other things that are connected to this are one, this is the place where Jesus is anointed. This is the place where Jesus becomes Christ, and how who Jesus is anointed to be, this Messiah, is a Messiah of the poor, and it's very clear. And so what Jesus stands for is bringing in another realm, and a realm here on earth where there will be no poverty, and that as Jesus' followers, we're also called to do the same things. And so if he's not anointed by this woman in this way, then we wouldn't have the kind of Jesus that we have. And so this is another, I think, level of emphasizing that it's not just giving a little bit of money here, but that actually standing for, you know, the anointing of Jesus to be a completely different kind of king than Herod, a completely different kind of ruler than Caesar, but someone who has been ordained by God to bring good news to the poor. And then I think that the last point is just unpacking a little bit more of most likely a critique of charity that is taking place in, and critique of money that is taking place in the whole Passion narrative. You know, it's the disciples who ask for the critique this woman and say that this money could have been, instead sold. I mean, this ointment could have been sold and for a large sum, and the money could have been given to the poor. Now, in John's gospel, who makes that critique is actually Judas. And it says in John's gospel that Judas said this not because he cared about the poor, but because he was the keeper of the money box. He's the treasurer. And so John's gospel admits that there are other reasons for trying to get money, trying to use the poor as an excuse to get money. And then Matthew's version doesn't have Judas doing that, but Judas does get money for selling Jesus out after this scene. And then with that money, he feels bad, and so he goes and returns it to the temple elites, trying to atone for turning Jesus over. And then what happens with that money is that it's turned into a potter's field for the poor. And that potter's field doesn't end up being a good thing. And then also in the Passion narrative, the guards are paid off at the tomb to not tell anybody that Jesus has been freed. And so even the kind of most traditional scholars basically say that the role that money plays throughout this whole story, starting with the disciples arguing with Jesus over what should have been done with this ointment or this money, shows that like it's always counter to spreading the good news of who Jesus is, and it's always as a tool of the emperors. And so it's just another thing. I could obviously go on, but there's other thoughts.
I want to read one quick thought from John Alexander that is actually a great little final thought to what you just said. He says, "Thank you. I enjoy your unpacking of the poor will always be with us." My dad quoted that to me at the end, to end a discussion on my 12-year question, why are there poor? So thank you for opening back to that question. So the next question comes from J.A., who says, "I work with the homeless and it's evangelicals who support my work. I find too often that they are preoccupied with saving the poor for Jesus than ministering to the poor, the Grand Commission or something like that. Your thoughts on that?"
Yeah, so I think this is a really, really important point. I mean, I think that, this particular passage, around the poor with you always, connects us to this idea that the reason people think people are poor is because they're sinners. And so then what we need to do is save the poor. One of the people that got me involved in this work many years ago, Reverend Dr. Yvonne Delk, who was the first Black woman to head up the United Church of Christ, she always said, we must move from seeing that poor people are sinners to seeing that poverty is a sin that could and should be ended. And I use that as a regular reminder in my work. Because I think that it's very true that many people are motivated to do something around poverty because we're trying to save people, sometimes win them over to Jesus, and thinking that if, people were just to pray more, pray harder, or do the right thing. I mean, it's a little bit like the story from Nicodemus from earlier, then sin no more, then folks wouldn't be poor in the first place. So I think actually the story of the Great Commission in Matthew is a great potential counter to this. I mean, so how it has been interpreted, right, is that people are sent out to all over trying to find disciples for Christ. But what the message that they're sent out with is one of bringing good news to the poor. Now, we've spiritualized what that good news is, right? So that's, words about who Jesus Christ is, but if you spend lots of time, as most of us on this call today do, amongst poor people, I mean, what could be better news to poor people than the ending of poverty? I mean, and the good news, the gospel of Jesus, I mean, when Jesus is talking across the gospels about good news to the poor, he's talking about a material reality, and he's living in that material reality. And so many of our churches have spiritualized everything, but if we start even with the prayer that Jesus teaches us, the Lord's Prayer, right? I mean, on earth as it is in heaven, forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors, right? These are not ephemeral, spiritual, otherworldly things. And he says it in the first place, on earth as it is in the sky, as it is in heaven. So there's no way to actually be doing Jesus's work of spreading the good news if you're not meeting the people's needs. Now, I think that still could present a problem to the situation that you're talking about, where the folks that are supportive of that work are people who are trying to save the poor. But I mean, I think if we don't actually root both our gospel readings in their context, not in some abstract scholarly way where, you know, where we don't see any connection, but knowing that 95% of the people that were living in Jesus's day that he was ministering to were folks that just were completely down and out, that Jesus was a part of a category of workers that could only live in that kind of poverty for 1 to 2 years before dying from their hard work. I mean, that this is that reality still with us today, and that Jesus had something to say about that material reality, that the only way we can follow, you know, Deuteronomy 15 doesn't tell us to you know, just to spiritualize everything. It's to release slaves. It's forgive debts. It's to meet people's economic needs, even if they're never going to be able to pay you back. And I mean, and the prophets, I mean, we can just go through the entire Bible and see that, like, we're talking about a very material, a very earthly reality that is still with us today. So, I mean, I think it is, I think it's not easy, but I don't know. There's more thoughts. So,
yes. There's more work to be done as well.
Yeah.
So, all right, here we go. So from Danielle, thank you so much for the time and presentation. My question is, Jesus said, blessed are the poor, for the kingdom of God is yours. We stand and fight for the rights of dispossessed and impoverished peoples. However, there is a theory that the poor are much more giving than the rich. How can we use this to push forward and pull ourselves to a sustainable level of poverty?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of really important things that you're raising here. So, for one, to even just start with, blessed are the poor, for the kingdom of God is yours. I mean, again, going back to this last point, I mean, we somehow have spiritualized this whole idea. Like, somehow people think that the kingdom of God is something that's otherworldly. It's somewhere else. People will get theirs when they die and go to heaven. But you know, in those Beatitudes, in that Sermon on the Mount, I mean, Jesus is very clear that he is here to bring in the reign of God, to bring in that kingdom of God, and that who he's doing that amongst is the poor. And so that the people that are in the lead of bringing what God wants for this earth to a reality in our time are poor people. And so I think it actually corroborates what you're saying about how much more generous poor people are than wealthy people, just statistically, just empirically. And I do think it says a lot about, therefore, how are we going to kind of change society for the better? How are we going to lift the load of poverty, as King likes to talk about? How are we going to, you know, really come to terms with this problem of poverty and do something effectively about it? And I think it speaks to the very important role of poor people ourselves, and that it needs to involve everyone. And you know, but that people that are struggling have a key and important role to play. You know, and so whereas as Matthew says it in the Sermon on the Mount, like, so that we're supposed to let our light shine. You know, we're supposed to actually recognize that we have a power and a freedom that could make poverty a little less, you know, bad, and in fact could even come to terms with ending it for everyone. And so, I mean, I think that this idea of us putting, you know, in our work, we've actually often talked about that poor people are resourceless but resourceful, and that we have to kind of turn our resourcefulness, our resourcelessness into the, you know, we can need to solve the problems that we're regularly having to solve anyways. And so, you know, we might not have the funding that a big organization has, or we might not have, but that, you know, we know how to come together and pool our resources to make sure that someone gets healthcare, or we know how to And I think being able to do that and us doing that on a regular basis, you know, in our communities, is like what a group of what People First is about. And so I think it's very biblically based, actually, that idea that we as people who are struggling can actually push forward for a new society and can actually, you know, help to actually do what God seems to intend for us, which is that we could live a life without poverty.
There's a great related comment from Jacob who's saying, you know, in thinking about what J.A. said above, but also I think fits with what Danielle and you just said. So Jacob writes, Jesus is reading from Isaiah, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me to proclaim good news to the poor, to set bond servants free." Along with most other social teachings in the New Testament, are spiritualized to the extent of having no substantial material, social, or terrestrial significance. How do we move the church past this?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a real, obviously, I think this is a real charge that I surely don't have the answers to. But, again, I can fall back on both the biblical texts that are there in a very material, social, terrestrial way, right? I mean, these texts are talking about the lives of people. In fact, the Bible is a compilation of stories of poor people organizing and being able to achieve something and then needing to organize more. That's how Deuteronomy got put together. That's how the Deuteronomic codes were even established, was that poor people organized for those rights, and then they were codified into law. Or the prophets, we have these stories of people crying out about all of this injustice, and that is material injustice. I mean, it's real inequities that existed. I think some of it is actually just going to these texts themselves and not being afraid to actually, you know, dive into those texts and battle it out with folks that are trying to spiritualize those, because the stories themselves are not spiritual stories. But then I think also the other thing we have to lean on is just the reality that so many of us are living today, which is what relevance would something that's completely spiritualized have to folks in Flint, Michigan right now who have a generation of children that have been poisoned knowingly by the people that were elected to protect them, right? I mean, so if God enters into that situation where God already is, I mean, it's in those lives of those families. I mean, that's where the divine is because, you know, and who's helping those moms who have for a year and a half now known that their kids are being poisoned and who have done everything they can to call attention to that reality. And so that is all, I mean, you can't have something spiritual to say to just that material reality, let alone, you know, in a place like the Gulf Coast, where also kids and families have been completely poisoned by the BP oil spill, even though it was 5 years ago, or to folks in West Virginia who, you know, are feeling the impact of Walmart or of mountaintop removal. I mean, just these realities of our lives, I mean, that are becoming, you know, just very common across this country and world. I mean, where you have to be based amongst folks that are hurting and are doing something about it. And so from there, I think we can move the church, because what does the church have to say about, you know, Marks, Mississippi? What does the church have to say about Lowndes County, Alabama, where there's open sewage, right? And is the church relevant to trying to find a solution to those problems? And where can we find in our Bibles and in our traditions something that gives us guidance about how we're called to respond to those kinds of situations? And again, I can assure you, I at least have not been able to find a spiritual argument other than one that is incredibly damning to people's lives right now, to those situations. And so only if you're willing to write off those people right now which, I mean, from my reading of the Bible, I'm not allowed to write off people's lives in the here and now. And so, like, so to me, that seems like, that's part of what we need to do. It's both link, I think, the Bible and then our realities of organizing today.
So we have a question from Leslie Jackson that may be a question that is on the minds of others. He says, thanks for sharing the link to the Bible study. It's good to see us, and it's good to see you as well, Leslie. Congratulations on completing your PhD, Liz.
Yeah, it took a while.
And where can we get a copy of your dissertation? He wants to read more about the Poor Will Be With Us, and I imagine that others have the same question.
Yeah, so we can put a link on our site to a website that has my dissertation on it if people are interested. I'm also turning it into a book, and it should be available in less than a year. And I have a variety of articles that I've written that are actually probably a lot more coherent than the little bit of ad hoc conversation I've been having right now on the Kairos website about that are kind of shorter versions and more popular versions of kind of some of this reinterpretation of that passage. So we can send definitely a link maybe to folks that are on this to the dissertation, and then we can also, I mean, there's probably five articles on the Kairos site right now that speak to a lot of the same things, but maybe with a little bit more accessible language, though I tried to make it pretty accessible.
So from John Alexander, I appreciate your distinction between spiritual and material. I see them as united around meaning. As in social justice, it's meaningful in both senses. Does this sound plausible?
Yeah, so I think that this is actually like incredibly biblically based as well. I mean, folks probably know, but the word for spirit, you know, in Hebrew is ruach, which is breath, right? So there's no way to separate breathing from spirit, right? I mean, like, what's more material than breathing? But then also, it's where the, you know, it's where something soulful, something spiritual comes into reality. And so yes, and I don't mean, I think this is also a really helpful kind of point to make, which is to not counterpose spirituality and materiality, but actually say that what Jesus stands for, what many of our religious traditions stand for, and what anyone that is interested in, you know, social justice needs to stand for is something more holistic that is rooted in, you know, that which makes life, which is breath. And so I think it's more than plausible. I think it makes a lot of sense. And I think that probably is also a good way to talk with folks that tend to, you know, other world eyes, you know, everything in the Bible. Which is to say that, like, you know, so for instance, one of the scholars that I actually really appreciate on the Beatitudes, you know, the difference between Luke and Matthew is the, you know, is blessed are the poor in spirit in Matthew, right? Versus blessed are the poor in Luke. Part of the reason I named my son Luke, right? But the point that Warren Carter makes about the poor in spirit in Matthew is it's like a double emphasis on the poverty. Like, these people are so poor, they almost can't breathe life into themselves. Like, that this is, so it's not that it's just that people don't go to church, they don't pray enough, they don't, you know, they don't follow the rules and regulations of our religious traditions, but it's that, but blessed are the poor who can barely get their breath together because they're being so oppressed by a system that devalues them, because theirs is the realm of God. And so I really appreciate that, but there's a spirituality to that, right? There's a valuing of everyone's life in that. So it's not that it's that, but the problem I have instead is when we immaterialize things, when we say that the material world doesn't matter, when we say that the poor will get theirs in heaven, and that's why it's okay for for folks to struggle on this earth, that's really where I think that is very counter to what Jesus is talking about and what our religious traditions teach us. And I think it relates to this Poor People's Campaign that I started off talking about, and I think anyone that's been following the Cairo Center has been hearing about. We're very interested in coming together with thousands of organizations and congregations to plan a new Poor People's Campaign around the 50th anniversary of the one that King originally launched. And I think what we see as really building towards that is a series of revivals. We're calling for like a massive kind of national revival tour, probably in the spring and fall of 2017, and would love for everyone here to get involved. And we see those revivals about reviving the spirit of struggle, the spirit of change, the spirit of resistance that exists in our communities. But in my understanding is the Holy Spirit that's there, that's helping us to be able to fight back and try to advocate for the lives that all of our families deserve and need. And so the idea around these revivals is that we'll have them, 5 or 7 or 10 places across the country with feeder events all over. Famous artists and celebrities will be there. There'll be poverty truth commissions where poor people will get a chance to not just tell their sad plights, but also talk about the fight and insight that poor people have for what needs to happen in our society to make it better. It'll be the coming together of people from all kinds of walks of life, all kinds of issues into something that could be big and powerful that could actually, change the current status quo of misery for so many. So it also ties into kind of this connection between material and spiritual, because these revivals will be surely both.
So I think that's a good point to pull our time together to a close and just put a call for everyone here today to continue to be in touch. And we want to be reaching out to you as these plans go forward. And also as Liz continues to continue to put her Reverend Doctor to use and continue to engage in doing these biblical reflections. And I'm sure that she would love to collaborate with anyone that's interested and has something that they're working on or a group that they're working with that wants to think about biblical texts. And so please be in touch with this with us, and we will be sure to be reaching out to you and hopefully coming to a town near you in the next years and as we pull all of this campaign and these revivals together. So thank you everyone for being here. I'll let Liz say the last goodbye. And
great, yeah, so thanks everyone. It's really good to see so many people. But just to echo what Colleen was saying, I mean, we're very interested in posting the sermons, the Bible studies, the materials that you all are putting together. Folks seem to be very hungry. We named the Cairo Center Kairos after, this very biblical or Greek word about a time, the kind of inbreaking of another moment of a time of change and renewal and when movements are born. And so in this time, people are so hungry for something different than what I think we often get out there. So as you write, as you write sermons, as you put different materials together, we really need folks to send those so that we can get them out to the folks that are in our network who are fighting in all these different fronts of struggle across the country. So thank you all, and hope that everyone had a very good King Day and that we all can try to live up a little bit to his legacy. All right, take care, everyone.